CorpoNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Greetings, this is Jim Ryan of the Great Debate RPG Podcast, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 179. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner.
And I'm Tracy Hurley, and in this episode, we're going to pump up a monster to break the world and figure out how to get through a game without breaking the other players. As we discuss world breakers and dealing with players with different styles at the table with Quinn Murphy from the At Will site. Quinn, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Quinn, who used to practically be a co-host he was on so often, we haven't talked to you nearly enough lately.
It's good.
Well, we've got a few news items to discuss, so I think we'll jump right into that. And the first one is that as of the day of this recording, that'll let people know exactly how long it took us to put it together and edit it. The Innie Awards are open for voting, and there are some prominent websites that people should keep in mind when they go to the Innies to vote, because they may be for people associated with this podcast and this episode especially. Because
Who is it?
Nominated for an Innie in Best Website is our own Sarah Dark Magic, Tracy Hurley.
Best blog, but yes.
Yeah. That's what I meant. Best blog. Tracy basically dominates the Sarah Dark Magic blog and has been nominated. Is this your first nomination for Sarah Dark Magic?
It's my first true nomination. I got an honorable mention last year.
Yeah, that's right. You got an honorable mention. And also, and I was going to mention this prior to knowing that Quinn was going to be our guest, because I happen to contribute on occasion to this website, is the At Will blog, which Quinn Murphy here runs. Congratulations,
Woo!
Sir.
Yeah, it's really pretty awesome. This is the first year I've actually applied for it, and it's pretty awesome. I'm still kind of in shock.
I'm happy to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited, and I hope it goes well. It makes it real hard to go in there and vote, though, and try to figure out who to vote for, because you know there's the two of you and all kinds of, you know, we're such a tight community that it's like most of the websites that or most of the blogs that were up for a nomination were people that we know, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's like there's no way I could possibly lose, whether Tracy gets it or the Critical Hits guy gets it or I get it or even what Thistle Game is the other one?
Gnome Stew's
there. You know, my personal three I'm looking for are At Will, Sarah Dark Magic, and Critical Hit. But I think, you know, it's all the sites are great. It's just cool. Like when you have a good list like that, really being nominated is a really great honor. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy about it.
I'm happy to be nominated too. I couldn't believe it. You know, I just thought last year was a fluke, but yay.
No fluke.
Now we got to get some of Tracy's any nominated magic over here on the podcast, huh?
Yeah.
Get on that, Tracy. Start sprinkling your fairy dust over here.
I need more Skittles.
Yeah, all right. You get your first payment in a couple weeks because Gen Con's coming up very soon.
Woohoo!
And speaking of the awesomeness of Tracy, the second news item is that your second PDF adventure from Postmortem has been released. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I wrote Black Rock Bandits. It's part of their six-pack series. Basically, it's supposed to fill 2 to 4 hours of gaming. Has about 2 combat encounters with the maps, although I did something a little different with Black Rock Bandits in that the 2 maps go together to form a complete dungeon. So, oh, I know.
Tracy made a dungeon?
I know. It's crazy. So, yeah, it's available from RPG Now and Paizo.com, among other places. It's a 4th edition adventure, just in case sometimes people wonder, and it's for level 1. And it comes with pregens, tokens, pretty much everything you need.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And speaking of, well, sort of speaking of, a little while ago we mentioned Gen Con and the innies and all that. There's another thing going on at Gen Con I wanted to make sure everybody knew about, and that is the media meet and greet at Gen Con. If you're going to be at Gen Con Saturday, 8 p.m. At the House, which is it's sort of a bar underneath the Union Station. It's kind of, Tracy, you went last year, right?
Yeah.
It's a little bit tricky to find, I guess, because it's sort of, you go in through the back of the Union Station, right?
Yeah.
And you sort of feel like you're going down into the cellar or something, like you shouldn't be down there. And then, oh, there's a bar with a bunch of cool people in it.
Yeah, I would have had a hard time finding it if Chris Sims wasn't going, because I just followed him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and on that note, I kind of thought it might be useful to people to see if they wanted to sort of get together ahead of time.
Okay.
So I thought maybe, you know, it starts at 8 o'clock. If we wanted to start gathering at like 7:45 outside of the convention center, if you know where Union Station is, it's just a couple blocks from the convention center, right?
Yeah.
And there's a door that exits. Last year it was sort of the area where there was a lot of construction going on. That door was. And so I thought just sort of outside that door facing Union Station. It's the only exit I know of that faces Union Station. We would just sort of gather there about 7:45.
Sounds great.
Start walking over about 8. So I'll be there, and then Tracy will be there, and Quinn will not because he can't go to Gen Con this year.
I know. I just think this part. I think this whole segment is just meant to make me cry.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the idea.
Reduce a game fiend to tears. So sad. So sad. But I'm not going to Gen Con for the best reason in the world. For when the birth of my new son, so I'll be chilling out with him.
Yeah, that's probably a good deal. All right, what else is going on in the world of D&D these days, Tracy?
Well, there's an upcoming game day for Neverwinter's release on August 6th, 2011. It's going to focus on the new campaign book and, I guess, the video game as well.
You don't seem too sure about that.
I don't know much about game day other than it's on Saturday during Gen Con.
You've never been to a game day?
I've been to one game day. I just don't know much about this particular one other than I've been kind of heads down.
Neverwinter's the new campaign setting book that's actually for the Forgotten Realms, which I know a lot of Realms fans were excited last year at Gen Con when they announced it, right? Because they originally said, we're going to put out 3 products for each setting and then we're done. And then they announced, oh, guess what, Realms fans, we're giving you another one. And so that's coming out. You know, I bet that'll be the big thing that they have this year at Gen Con, like they had Dark Sun last year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's the game day is during Gen Con, and they're going to do a whole day of playing this game day adventure, which will be pretty cool. And it's funny because I know about Neverwinter because my brother played the video games and stuff. So I didn't even know what Realms was, but I knew what Neverwinter was.
Very cool.
Go ahead.
Oh, and they'll be launching the Neverwinter fortune cards.
Yeah,
with that, right?
Fortune cards. There's a new video game, I think, by Atari. Mm-hmm. Coming out along with it, but Bob Salvatore, the R.A. Salvatore's Drizzt novels. The last one was set around Neverwinter, and it's called the Neverwinter Trilogy. So he's got a second book coming out soon. In the area, they're really sort of pumping up this concept. Like everything WotC,
that's cool,
in the next month or two seems to be based around this idea of Neverwinter.
Yeah, and after the game day, the new encounters season will be Lost Crown of Neverwinter. So the characters that, if you play a character at game day, you're going to be able to bring that over to the encounter season.
Oh, that's really cool. Actually, I'll be running the game day, but not. Well, I actually haven't determined if I'll be running the encounters. Maybe I'll link those both up.
Hold on, that's cool. Yeah, I try to make it to game days because they're relatively few and far between. Encounters are hard for me being weekly just because that's a time commitment, and I'm a family man and a teacher and all that, right? So.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to be at the game day or at Gen Con or out there in public with gamers around in general, I would encourage everybody out there to make sure they're wearing a Tome Show t-shirt. I mentioned this a while ago, but I want to try to remind people every now and then that we have a Cafe Press store, which has all kinds of Tome Show Jeff Greiner meme shirts. So if you want to go out in public and curse the name Jeff Greiner, then awesome. Go to cafepress.com/tomeshowproductions, and we'll have it linked in the show notes as well, so you can find that there. I know I think I bought 3 shirts. Mike Shea's got a shirt. I know Tracy's going to be wearing one at Gen Con.
Yes.
I may have purchased a few as gifts for some people as well. So if you want to run around with a Jeff Greiner or a Tome Show t-shirt, make sure to hop over there and get it. Other than that, also, I wanted to mention in the last advice episode from last month, we talked to Matt Goetz and Eric Scott DeBee about aquatic games, and we built sort of in discussion, we talked about building the Anguillian monster, which was this eel-like humanoidish thing from a previous product way back an edition or two ago. And I sort of mentioned in passing, oh, hey, it'd be great if you guys could put together some stat blocks, and I'll put them up in the show notes. And then it didn't happen, and I went ahead and posted the episode without it, and it wasn't a big deal. And then, a week or so later, suddenly I got this document from them. And it's not just the stat block for the monster, but 3 different versions of the monster, including lore and tactics, and then 2 support monsters for it, and all this information. It was this really incredible document. So I took some time and formatted it and made it look a little bit prettier. Oh, and Matt even had his wife, Roxy, put together some awesome new original artwork for it. I was really impressed. So I turned it into a PDF and released it on the Tome Show's feed the other day. So I think you should make sure to check that out, too, because I think it turned out really nice.
The art on that is I've gamed with Matt and Roxy, and I've seen Roxy's stuff there, and I saw that picture. It was a great picture.
Yeah.
And of course, Matt and Eric did a great job on the stats and stuff too.
I want to hire her to do some stuff for me. If I just need to come up with a project for her. And the last thing to talk about, because we got a lot of news apparently tonight, Tracy.
Well, I just wanted to mention that Lost City's out, and there's 2 people on this podcast who worked on it, so...
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, you're still here?
In fairness, I wasn't even a patron, so there's no chance I could have even wanted to be a writer on it.
But yeah, so go and buy it, and it's awesome, and all the reviews I've seen so far have just been great about it.
And Lost City is...
It's an open design source book. Do you want to talk about it, Quinn?
Yeah. It's basically a sandbox world. Tracy and I both wrote for it. Logan Bonner was the lead design on it. It's basically this city underneath the sands, and it's basically like a open area for you to explore, and it's just a big sandbox setting, lots of really great design elements that you can use, so you can sort of go through it as a full thing, take elements here and there, just make it a locale that you can borrow from in like another campaign world. It's really versatile without trying to be everything all at once. The core content of it, what it is strong, and you can sort of use it wherever.
Right on. And Tracy, you did the underground water system for the setting, right?
Yeah.
And Quinn, what was your big contribution?
The Oklu. They're basically sort of these chameleon people who used to be servants for the giants that had ruled the city before, and now with the giants gone, they still live there, still trying to sort of emptily carry out the giants' wishes. And they're kind of interesting. They have this very kind of impressionable yet almost sort of robotic psychology to them, so that makes for some pretty intriguing interactions.
Very cool. I, as a rule, try not to buy any open design projects if they don't have the writings of my friends in them. So I end up buying a lot of stuff from it, it turns out.
That's a problem with knowing lots of people, Jeff.
Yeah, I got to stop doing that.
So before we get into the meat of the show, let's take a break to talk about our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games. They're back.
Yay.
A website where you can get new game books and out-of-print items as well. Our pick for this episode is actually the Dungeon Master's Guide 2 for 4th edition, which has some great advice, including how to construct stories to appeal to players of all sorts of types, and also runs you through some ideas for building your own monsters.
Which is directly connected to the things we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. And it's actually almost like $10 off. It's $25 from Noble Knight.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, let's talk to Quinn a little bit. Get to find out what's going on with you. Find out what's up to you. Now, we probably don't need to go into the long, detailed history of who is Quinn Murphy.
Well, it all started when I was a child.
Yeah. but there's some new things going on in your world, and I thought it'd be worth the time to mention some of those. And you already mentioned one. You've been quite busy lately, probably mostly so with the arrival of your first child.
Yeah. John. Oh, sorry.
I was just gonna say congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. No. John Henry Murphy. He's a steel driving baby. he's definitely been keeping us busy, but that's been just amazing. Not really. I talk a lot, but I don't really have good words to talk about how amazing that is.
Yeah, that's very cool. As a father myself, and a father, a new father as well, at the same time, I completely understand that situation. But you've got some other more geeky things going on, although you know. Raising your own minion is a pretty geeky thing, but if you do it right.
Yes.
Nice. Soon the minion will be setting traps by leaving toys everywhere. But so I think one of the things you've been talking about a lot lately is how to quickly set up a game to run, because that sometimes is an issue, at least in D&D, where you want to play a game, but it takes a while to come up with scenarios and everything. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had, for the previous thing we were just talking about, had to sort of put stuff on hold for a bit. I was starting to get into the notion of a prepless is sort of a very ambitious way to describe it, but low prep version of D&D. And instead of, there's a way of going through and setting up for 4E where you're sort of trying, you're playing, so you're laying tracks out in a predictive manner, right? You're trying to see where the characters are going to go and then sort of laying the track out there, which can really work, especially if you know your players and stuff like that. You can sort of lay down where they're going to go. But then that also takes a lot of prep because you need to have the tracks there. And it's not quite, even though I'm talking about tracks, I don't mean it's railroading because you're letting the characters steer. You're just building the world in front of them as they move. What I've been looking at is just, and sort of trying to talk about a lot more is what I've been working with is just setting up situations where there's, and then just sort of rolling and improving with what the people are doing there. So it's cut my work down, and I've done this in other games a lot, but I've really sort of looked at 4E because 4E has a certain set of constraints in its design where it looks like on the surface that you can't even do that because, how are you going to do your battle mats? How are you going to set up your encounters, There are all these things that, how are you going to do your skill challenges? All these things that make you think that 4E needs to be prepped. But there are different techniques that you can use that I'm getting into that cut down on that considerably.
So I actually don't know much about this. Vengeance? I heard that mentioned lately.
Yes, Vengeance, and I will just want to say for loyal Atwill readers, I will not release this before I release the Lawbreakers, but it is something up, running up concurrently with that. The Vengeance mechanic is kind of a, like lately I've just been having these nifty little sort of side pseudo mechanic things for monsters, and the Vengeance one is an interesting way to work with minions and elites, where basically, let's say you've got a room full of minions and a few elites sprinkled in there, and the players are just having at it with minions like they do, right? And then let's say those elites have this power, and the power is really pretty outrageous. Not completely outrageous, but very strong. And but they don't even get to use it until X minions die,
right?
Right? Let's say when 5 minions die, the power charges up for the first time, and every 5 minions after that, it recharges. And that's basically the heart of Vengeance, right? And there are lots of different things that you can do with it, because you can have different groups. You can have minion A with elite monster A. You can have minion B with elite monster B, and you can mix them all in one thing, so you have two different sets of Vengeance things that you have to work with, you know, and then it forces the players to make decisions on targeting, yep. Right? You know, we can go through and kill all the minions and have to worry about this, you know, really jerky elite, or we can go for the elite. And then the other side of it is that the Vengeance mechanic also has sort of an elite power, so if you kill the elite, it leaves behind something for the minions. So there's sort of a, it's not a, you know, oh, it's just kill the elite first. Like, something's going to happen either way, and players will just sort of decide which they'd rather have happen.
Right.
Okay. I look forward to seeing that. And you mentioned that this isn't going to come out until after the Lawbreakers finally see the light of day, which I've been waiting for ages. You originally announced Lawbreakers and Worldbreakers at the same time.
Yep.
And then you've spent the last, it seems like, 3 years talking about Worldbreakers. and finally you said you're going to start talking Lawbreakers, because that's a concept that I really enjoyed. So remind us all from 27 years ago when you announced it, what the Lawbreaker concept is that you're going to see.
How many years keep growing every time you reference this?
100 years ago, man.
I'm getting older every minute, dude.
So basically, we'll get into the Worldbreakers in a second, but you know,
yeah.
With those, you're basically have this monster that's sort of changing the environment around it, right? And it has this sort of super presence. With the Lawbreaker, you have something that basically is so talented and so skilled, they've sort of found something that basically violates some, you know, principle of your game universe, right? You know, some guy who finds, you know, a way to, you know, connect himself with the Shadowfeld and become a being of living shadow. You know, they've sort of broken the rules in some way, and they're sort of like, where the Worldbreaker is more like, oh man, how can we deal with this environment and the way that it temporarily changes the rules of the game to prevail? The Lawbreaker is, how do I figure out what this guy's doing? You have to basically unlock the ability to defeat it. So, you know, it's a classic where the Worldbreakers are influenced more by like video games. Mm-hmm. The Lawbreaker is influenced more by movies, right? Like, that's a classic thing. Like, oh, there's a villain who's undefeatable until we figure out what his Achilles heel is, until we unravel his crazy special ability.
Yeah, didn't I hear a conversation recently? Was that a DMR, Tracy? What, 3 or 4 episodes ago, where you guys were talking about the whole, like, alien concept and how you had to do the study and figure out the weakness and all that kind of stuff? Trying to figure out a way to do that? It sounds like the Lawbreaker concept might be a good way to go about that as well. Although maybe a little bit different, but yeah, a modified version. Very cool. And then along with that, you've been spending the last, I think we determined it was 739 years, working on the World Breaker project, which you yes. just announced. And I've had a chance to look at the first sort of creature from that bunch, and it looks awesome and very exciting. So talk to us a little bit about the World Breaker project.
Okay, yeah, we had a Kickstarter on it in November. October, and it ended beginning of November. And we've been working on it now. There, you know, done a lot of play testing and development on it. It's if you ever look on the site for it, you're going to find that the final version of it. And I'll next week I'll have something up. On the site talking about the changes that we made and going through, because it's substantially different now. Mm-hmm. But basically we have this monster where you're going to can I talk about, should I talk about Etherkai specifically a little bit, or
however you want to do it? I'm looking at Etherkai right now as you talk.
Yeah, I just opened it okay. too.
All right, so you've got Etherkai, who's the first guy, Etherkai the Nightmare Dragon, and you have this dragon who is sort of all like all good dragons, sort of like full of himself, and like, you know, and he was particularly full of himself, and he thought like, hey, I'm this Underdark dragon, I'm going to get these people to worship me, and it kind of went sour on him, and his people actually found a real god, and then he found himself on the outs being tortured by said god. And when he found himself being tortured by Sun God for 100 years, you know, he basically lost it. And he found, nobody knows how, but, you know, he found some way to escape. And now he's this dragon who has taken all the stuff that he suffered and is able to use his magical and psychic powers against you. And so once we've sort of like established this big screen kind of thing with him, basically he has two modes. He has like his regular mode where he's attacking you, and then when you bloody him, he gets this temporary reservoir of hit points, and he gets to add stuff to the environment. And then you're sort of fighting this new set of powers. Indeed, and one of the key things to World Breakers is that the mechanics are, there are a lot of different mechanics, I won't get into them all, but that a lot of the mechanics themselves are very unconventional, things that probably the first time your players come into it will be like, what the heck? Right? Like he'll make an attack roll by making an opposed skill check, mm-hmm. you know, and then, you know, you get something if you win, he gets something if he wins, you know, he'll have, there are lots of mechanics where players get to make choices. Not always the funnest choice, mm-hmm. but they, you know, they'll choose like, do you want to take a bunch of damage, or do you want to take stun? Do you want to do this or that? You know, and a lot of it is just sort of, you know, when he's in that World Breaker mode, he's not really looking like a normal monster at all. He's kind of changed the game. And then once you get past that, then he sort of goes back to the normal monster and you fight him through there. So this is a staged encounter worked right into the monster.
And it's sort of like the video game monsters that inspired it, right? Where you're fighting the big boss guy, and at a certain point, he changes into a different creature.
Exactly,
and,
right.
And changes the world around him, and suddenly you're in space, and he's grown a second head, and all that kind of crazy stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And actually, as somebody who was towards the beginning of this process actually writing some World Breakers for you, I really like some of the changes you've made in the concept and how, you know, there were things that I did, and I ran several World Breakers in my own game that I made myself and all that kind of stuff, right? And there were a few things that like always kind of bothered me a little bit, and mm-hmm. I wasn't sure how to fix them. Mm-hmm. It looks like you've come up with some really good ideas on how to address those things.
I'll say if someone's looked at the World Breakers earlier and were like, oh, I didn't like this about it and stuff, chances are we didn't either. So so we changed those things. So like with the, you know, one of the things was this one of the big themes in the early part of the project was this notion of counting rounds, like the yeah. World Breaker would go on for X amount of rounds.
Right. Yeah.
And there's, you just don't count rounds in 4E. It's against pretty much everything else 4E is doing. Mm-hmm. So the temp hit points actually work much better.
Yeah, I think that works really well. And I like how you even have like normal attacks that work a little bit differently when the Worldbreaker mode is active, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I like how you've done that, too. So, you know, normally he's got a bite attack and a claw attack, but if he's in Worldbreaker mode, then those do a little bit of extra something as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things I learned a lot from, you know, somewhere in the process of working on this product, the Monster Vaults were released. Mm-hmm. And the Monster Vaults are great pieces of monster design. They are great pieces of monster design. So I basically learned a lot of lessons from there. So, and one of the great things about the Monster Vault monsters as they do is you'll see that there's this, people talk about power creep in 4E all the time, but in the monsters you see a vast reduction in the amount of powers given to monsters. Mm-hmm. You know, if you compare a Monster Vault monster to its equivalent in, say, Monster Manual 1, you'll see like that Monster Manual 1 might have like 4, 5, 6 powers for a regular monster, while the other one has like 2. But they're more expressive. You know, so we try to compress them too, because one problem when you're a GM is, how can I run all this stuff, right? You know, like uh-huh. a really complex monster, you can't keep all the stuff in your head. So we try to squeeze it down and simplify where we can.
Very cool. Well, we've been talking for over a half hour now. I think it's time to get into the meat of things. And since we're talking Worldbreakers, and since I believe one of the things that we're doing tonight is building a Worldbreaker concept, I think it's time to sort of get into that. That's going to be our build something for this. And I told Tracy she has to be the inspiration for it, because usually in these kinds of things, I double up and I say, hey, you know what? I've got a game coming up. Let's build something for my game, right? And so I get a little bit of extra benefit, because that's the advantage of being the host of the show, right? But Tracy's a host of the show now too. And so I'm going to have her take the lead. So Tracy, Quinn, you're going to make a Worldbreaker? Go.
Nice. Well, unfortunately, I'm not running a game right now, so I won't get double duty right now for it. But, you know, maybe I'll get partial credit if you ever put this online.
Yeah.
Sweet. So my thought was a fire demon, because I like fire demons. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's cool to have fire just spread everywhere. So do you have any ideas?
Well, yeah. I mean, like one thing that I like to do when I'm designing not just the Worldbreakers but any monster is I sort of like to get into sort of the big picture, sort of like I like to try and envision how it's going to be messing up my players, right? If I can get a couple of good like snapshots of it, you know, uppercutting the fighter, or you know, delivering a left hook to the wizard, right? Like, freeze those in my mind, then that helps me build everything out. So like, are you picturing, so I'm picturing this fire demon is large, right?
Yeah, I think large is good.
And like do you had any vision of like any kind of stuff that it's doing? You know, I mean, fire demons are, you know, it's easy to imagine they're going to burn stuff, but do you have a name for it?
No. Jeff told me about this like yesterday.
Well, we can name it and everything too, but yeah, you know, just
yeah. No, I think it would be cool if this was kind of something that they didn't know that they were going to go face, like if they're going through a dungeon or something, and they end up in a room that the fire demon's been in. I don't know beyond that right now. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, so here, I'll run with this for a second, and you tell me.
Okay.
How this fits what you've got. Let's say, you know, if they're stumbling on it, in a room somewhere, what if it was, if we tweak that, what if we made it some sort of ifrit?
Okay.
Right. You know, still fiery. Right. And then also sort of, since it's sort of djinn related, also the sort of thing you might find bound in an object in a dungeon.
Okay.
And what if and I'm just sort of going off the top of my head here. What if that ifrit, what, you know, is bound to, I don't know, maybe a brazier, razor kind of thing. some sort of candle, and what if he sort of, his powers sort of are almost like an expression of his sort of, like he was maybe bound there to serve some other lord, and his powers were there to, are sort of an expression of him maybe breaking those chains. So like, okay. what if like a chains of fire? So instead of just like, you know, so when he goes into that special mode, maybe he pops up, the players are talking to him, and negotiations go, you know, regrettably sour, how they tend to with PCs and monsters. And when they're, when they go south, you know, they start fighting him, and then he has, when he sort of gets bloodied, he pops out instead of just like maybe like a field of fire, like maybe you'd expect there. What if there are these fire chains?
Okay.
That went over and basically like on the field acted as sort of mechanically acted as sort of walls, but like maybe movable walls, like sort of fire, like, you know, like if you took the flame wall. Okay. Wizard spell and sort of made that the environment so he can sort of make these chains that whip out.
Okay.
And then he can control sort of where, you know, each turn he controls where they're at. And so the players have to sort of maneuver around these flaming chains and deal with something. Does that sound?
Okay. Yeah.
Can I interject a concept?
Yeah. Yeah.
As I'm listening, one of the really cool ideas that have sort of come up in my head is I like the idea of this Ifrit being bound to something, and so, and he's stuck there, like he's immobile. But when he becomes bloodied and he activates his Worldbreaker ability, it's also him breaking his bindings. So by bloodying him, you've gotten yourself closer to defeating him, congratulations, but you've also freed him, which is actually what he wanted all along.
Ooh, that's really good. Yeah, we could totally work with that. And then and maybe what he's doing is he is able to sort of free himself off your life force. Like if okay. he can sort of, you know, he could finish the job by draining the PC's life force and fully free himself.
You know, could whatever he's attached to be kind of like an unknown artifact of some great wizard or something, like a candelabra of understanding or whatever. But it turns out that the reason nobody knows that there was like this Ifrit bound to it, that was what provided the power in it. I don't know.
So by freeing them, they've also depowered the artifact?
Well, they've depowered the artifact, and it also explains why they wouldn't necessarily know that this guy is here, but gives them a reason to go to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would totally work. And then you know, we'd assume he has... So in the world... Going back to this... I like this concept of he's freeing himself during the... in the Worldbreaker mode. And we're going to keep the chains, right? Mm-hmm. So then what I like to do is sort of once I figure out like I usually would try and figure out sort of that concept, like what the monster is, then I'll try and figure out what the Worldbreaker is, like first off, because that really influences everything else, right? Then I try and look at, okay, what are some of the powers that go along for this? So, you know, something that could work with him, again, this is just sort of off the top of my head, maybe once he has those flame chains out there, he can create things that come out, like flame minions that come out of the walls.
Okay,
emerge from the chains.
Yeah.
There. As sort of one of the major powers, and then, you know, maybe like reflections of himself, sort of flame reflections coming out. And then maybe he can turn one of those What if he can turn one of the chains into like a whip?
I have an idea on the minions.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the idea that you mentioned of he's trying to use the life force of the PCs. And mm-hmm. that what if he's burning some of the life force out of the PCs to create the minions? So you sort of have this effect of sort of a fiery, you know, a ghost, fiery ghost, whatever image coming out of the PC and becoming the minion.
That's great. And then you could mechanically express that maybe as he deals some damage and maybe a healing surge loss. Mm-hmm. And that healing surge loss is how many minions that he'll summon too.
Yeah.
So yeah. You know, hits you, drains there. So yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, and that's just the kind of thing. And what I like to do here too is because you're going to be tweaking these mechanics that are, you know, like sometimes people will look at the world breaking and be like, oh my God, it's going to do this harsh thing. But I always try and sort of balance it either by letting players choose or giving some other kind of thing with it, like an imposed skill roll, say. You could, with that, maybe give the player a choice, like take this damage and lose healing surge and summon the minions, or take a whole bunch more damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so if they, you know, if they fully resist, they just burn a lot. But if they don't, they, you know, get some of their sort of life essence taken, and it makes the minions.
Let the fire go, but lose some of your life in the process.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and it could be one of those things that people decide one choice until they're like, oh, I can't do this. I can't actually do this right now. And then they, you know, go back and choose that. And that's fine, too. But, you know, make sure, you know, a big thing of making the Worldbreaker fights really fun. Because that's one thing I guess I feel I should say, too, is that I definitely want the Worldbreakers to be challenging for groups. But I actually build for interest first. What I want is for players to remember the fights, because players can do horrible things to monsters, right? You know, all it takes is a couple bad die roll and your awesome monster is street pizza, right? You know, and that's a risk when you build solely for challenge. But if you can try and build something where it's interesting, where the players are doing things that they don't always do, and moving around some, you can make the you know, even if they mechanically just tore through the monster in a few rounds, they'll remember like, whoa, wasn't that weird when he did that thing? Yeah, like, and that was crazy when we had the things coming out. You know, like they'll remember the things that are happening. So you know, we'll try and build to make interesting things happen and let challenge be what it's going to be.
So maybe while he's chained down, he has some sort of resist of damage that gets reduced as the chains go away, but then when the chains are away, he's free.
Well, what about this? What if he starts chained in the Worldbreaker? Like when he's not in Worldbreaker, he starts in chains, chained up, and then when he goes into Worldbreaker, he frees. So, like, what if they're fighting like a slow brute at first? And then, you know, riffing off what you're saying, right? And then when the chains sort of go off and extend around the room, then he's freed, like you're saying, and then he becomes, like, faster, like, almost like a...
He becomes a skirmisher.
Yeah, he goes from, like, a brute to a skirmisher.
And he can actually use the chain slash wall things that he's created to transport himself around the room.
Yes.
Okay.
I like it.
You know, and... So now, one thing I should cover here too is, and we will probably won't be able to. It takes a while to do, but it's something to think about. The concept of an opening. So what one of the things that makes Worldbreakers, one of the things that balances them, also makes them a lot funner, too, for players, is this concept of the opening. When the Worldbreaker happens, so you know you've bloodied the monster, its turn starts. Boom! You know, the chains fly off. And then the players get a chance during this opening sequence to react. And there's basically like a mini skill challenge. in there. So, you know, you have basically anywhere from 2 to 3 different options with a few associated skills that the players can try to do. So, you know, and again, we don't have to do the full thing, but you might have options like, you know, hey, you get, you know, you've managed to, you know, resist the draining effects of the fire. And so you get a resist to, you know, maybe this Ifrit does necrotic stuff too when it's draining. You know, you gain a resist to necrotic. Or you gain some moderate countermeasure to something to one of the abusive things that it does.
Right. Like maybe it can't take your healing surges for a turn or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You can gain, you know, you can, you know, or maybe it, you know, does it less than others, things like that. So you can give the players a chance to, you know, it's not a guarantee, it's still like a skill roll, but they get a chance to figure out, okay, this is going to go kind of crazy, you know, and especially before they've seen what it's doing, they're like, well, you can do this and get this. And one of the things that'll happen with the players will go, wait, why do I need resist all death? Right? What power could that be that would require that? Because you don't have to tell them what power that could be used for that, right? You know, and so then you've got them sort of worrying what's going on, and you know, it's fun times.
Yeah, it's kind of like looking at the achievement lists of some games, and you're like, wait, survive an 80-foot fall? There's 80 feet.
You know, you're looking. Yeah.
So it sounds like you've got the beginning concept of this guy more or less figured out. Is there anything else other than actually starting to build powers? Because, I mean, we don't probably have time to actually build them out in full detail.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's basically it. And, you know, and that's a lot of when I'm doing the monster, sort of like a lot of my basic creative process is sort of, you know, like we're doing that sort of visual concept work, you know, and just like how we were doing there, where sort of we started one thing and then, oh, wait, what if we tweaked it like this, and just making it not just unconventional, but really interesting, because there's also, I think, from what we've just developed, and this is one of my really important things here, there's a story mm-hmm. to it. Like you can see, even in just the concept that we laid out, there's this, like, why is this guy bound up in chains, right? Like, why is he free? You know, there's some story behind how he got to be this crazy monster. and even if we don't fully explore it in play, we can get that sense as players mm-hmm. that this guy is more than just a solo that we're going to fight.
Yeah, we didn't just pick him out of the monster manual or something. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but...
Right.
Very cool. Well, I expect that in a couple of weeks you'll send us an awesome document with all this statted out, right, Quinn?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do something like that. When I get it, I'll send it your way.
Yeah. I don't expect you to take the time to do all that. You've got your own to do. But if you do have the time to put together some notes or whatever, that'd be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, and if nothing else, it'll give people a taste of what they're going to get in the other World Breakers in the project that they should make sure to run out and buy.
Yes, but go buy 20 copies if you want.
They absolutely should. Okay, so let's go ahead and let that simmer for a bit. Get that? Simmer? Fire? Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
Smooth.
And go on to our advice segment, where we're going to talk about how to deal with... As a player or a DM, having people at the table that want different things from their experience, that have different styles of play. At my game table, I have 7 different players and 1 DM, and all of us have different play styles and want to get something different out of the game. And yet somehow we all have to walk away feeling like we had a good time. How do I do that? How is it possible that 8 people that all want different things out of a game can walk away having a good time?
Wait, people have different get different things out of the game?
What do you mean there's more ways to play?
Good question. Well, it turns out some people really like the tactics and the strategy and the optimization and going in and killing things part of the game. Some people really like the role-playing and the acting. Some people are storytellers, and they're into the overall story, and the details of all that is a little bit less important. There's all kinds of different ways to enjoy D&D, it turns out. I know, for example, as I understand it, Mike Shea is on that strategic side of the game. I'm a big fan of the storytelling side. I'm a storyteller myself. I would guess that, Tracy, you're probably more of a role player person.
I'm somewhere in between all of them.
Okay. And I think that's fair. I think as a storyteller, I also enjoy a good fight. You know, I also enjoy getting into the role play and all that. So there's all these different people. And if I'm somebody who wants to deal with the role playing, and somebody else really wants to just run in and kill stuff, then how do we both walk away happy? How does the person who wants to be killing stuff all the time stomach the 2 hours that I spent talking to the guards?
Well, hopefully you're not spending the 2 hours consecutively talking to the guards. I think that would be one.
And there's other, I mean, even then you can get even more granular with the differences, right? Some people are the, well, there's the bad guy, let's run in and kill him. And then some people are the, well, I'm the sneaky rogue type, I want to try to sneak past him or get around or set up an ambush, and they want to talk tactics for an hour or whatever, right? There's all kinds of different ways of approaching the game and how to do things in the game. How do those different players with different styles handle each other?
Well, I think the first step to so many themes in life, but this problem in particular demands it, is everybody's got to get to the common point where they can understand that nobody gets what they want all the time, right? The person who wants never-ending combat is not going to be able to get it all the time, right? You know, and that you'll do your best to accommodate them, right? But, it's the hardest thing for a GM, right? You know, it's that you have people who advocate very strongly for that one thing they want to do, but you have across the table the other person advocating just as hard. You know, it's like getting people to compromise and be willing to split up some of that time. Like, maybe you can't get, 2 hours of just nothing but fights. Maybe you can get like an hour split up.
So if I'm understanding your advice here correctly, you're basically saying to everybody out there, grow up and let other people have fun too.
Well, to start with, just to break down, because I've played at tables and I've been with people who are very uncompromising, mm-hmm. in their particular version of fun, and that's where I found where it usually starts, right? If everybody can compromise and go, okay, I don't get what I want all the time, but, I get what I want as much as it's possible, and I can live with that.
But Quinn, that's not what my character would do.
So I think what we're saying is people have to agree that they want, like, this is what they want, or else it's just not going to work. So.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, if it's really a non-starter that, you can't, that you can't have all combat or all role playing, depending on which side you fall on, then you probably need a group that's going to give you that all the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it's to the point that your group just absolutely can't give you what you need to have fun, your advice is find a different group.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't compromise, then that's where you're at.
Although, I think for a lot of people, that's not particularly useful advice, right? Because most people don't have, lots of different gaming groups to choose from. They got the group that they've got, and that's their choices. And I think in most cases, and probably 98% of cases, you don't need to go to that point, right? I think there's,
right.
I think
right.
Most people can find ways to make it work without getting to the point that you've just got to leave and find another group,
Right. That's why this is the first step.
Yeah, this, and that's compromise. I mean, most people don't have to go there because most people are willing to compromise. I've seen a few things where like, oh, that's, like you were joking around, that's not what my character would do. And I'm not going to do something my character would not do. It's like, well, if you can't compromise, then, what can we do?
Right.
But most people compromise.
And I think And I've been that guy, right? I think some of that just comes with maturity as well, right? I've gotten to a point where it's like, you know what, this is a story, and I'm in charge of this character, so I determine, in fact, right, what that character will and won't do, and if it means that I have to compromise my vision of that character a little bit, change that vision of that character a little bit, then fine. Change that vision of that character so that they are the kind of person who would do that. Or at least go along with it begrudgingly and not happy about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's fair. I think that's an okay thing to do. You know, and I think understanding that everybody needs to have a chance to have their spotlight or have their moment of doing what they mm-hmm. want to do is fine to do. And as a DM, of course, you also have to try to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. Truth. I think a good next step, like once we sort of establish the baseline here is that we're going to try and get along. I think a good next step from a GM point of view is see how, and this is sort of D&D heresy, but see how you can split the party. see how you can split the party in sensible ways. You know, obviously, if you send five people on five different directions all the time, that's going to get to be a bear to manage. But if you can split into, like, let's say you've got, you know, a perfect equal split of role players to people who like combat, right? Like, is there a way that you can have the people who like combat in a small skirmish fight while other people try and do the role playing aspect of it? And then basically you just give each group a couple turns.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you can do that. I would probably do that more experimentally than I would on a regular basis, though, because that's something that's hard to pull off consistently and well. You know what I'm saying? Like, I could pull that off every now and then, but the amount of energy and planning to do that in a way that where everybody's going to be having fun and the people role-playing aren't bored while the combat's going on, or the people in combat aren't bored while the role-playing's going on or whatever, is tough to pull off, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a tool in the toolbox, but not necessarily something I would do on a regular basis. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So what would you do?
I think a lot of it comes, I mean, as a DM, I think, like when we've talked about, you try to provide a variety of different things for people, know your players, talk to your players, try to figure out what they want, and give them the opportunity to do that, right? And sometimes that's easy, right? If I want to give my players an opportunity to do some role playing or some contemplating, I guess, some strategizing, right? I find that kind of stuff really easy to provide for my players. I come up with a few NPCs or a few concepts or whatever, a mystery for them to figure out or what have you, and they will spend an hour or two discussing it amongst themselves and talking to people and casting rituals to figure out what's going on and doing all kinds of stuff, right? And they've entertained themselves, and they've had a blast doing this on multiple occasions. And then at some point in the night, they get to move along to wherever they're going, and then I provide the people that want the fight and the tactics the chance to use all that. And I try to make sure that that anything that I'm doing in my game is progressing the storyline constantly so the storyteller is happy. You know, as a storyteller myself, that's important as well. So I think as a DM, you do that. I think the hard part is the players, because it's hard as a player to allow all of that to happen, right? There are times that I've sat as a player and I've gotten bored and I'm not engaged in what's going on, although somebody else is having fun, right? And so I just sit there and I let them do their thing and I don't mind, you know. Sometimes the approach is, you know what, I'll just sit here and be bored and let them have fun because I'm willing to make that sacrifice, right? But I think you can do better than that. I think it's not just a matter of sharing the spotlight and letting those people have their fun. I think if you get involved and try to help them have fun, you're going to find that you're having more fun yourself.
Get out of my brain. Because that's what I was just going to say.
Well, take it away. I've talked too much.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. That was basically where I was going to go. Sort of, you know, it's easy to sit there bored and let, you know, okay, they're going to do their thing. But if you think, like, okay, how can I help in the fun, and this is something that GMs can also sort of encourage by letting people, like, you know, there's in almost any say, role-playing situation, there's, like, some detail or minor bit that's not, that might be involved in the scene, but isn't really important, that you could, you know, like, you know, so you walk into this, you know, tavern. Hey, person who's not doing something right now, what's the name of the tavern? Right? You know, and you can sort of, you can, as a GM, you can sort of encourage this kind of stuff that, that you can, players who aren't in the spotlight can still add stuff into the story or just, you know, be involved and try and encourage other people. And then, you know, but key to that is that it sort of has to rotate, right? You know, if I'm helping you out when you're in the spotlight, then when I'm in the spotlight, you know, don't just sit there and doodle, you know, try and help me out.
Yeah,
you know?
And I think as a DM, you can encourage that a little bit too. And that's something I haven't always been good at, right? There are times where there's clearly four out of my five or six players really engaged and two or three people sitting around not really involved. And I might go around and say, okay, they're in the middle of doing all this. What are you guys doing? And they give me something. It's like, well, you know, immediately I'm like, okay, well, you're not doing anything particularly important, and we'll move on and get back to the people that are doing something important, right? But I think as a DM, I could do a better job of saying, okay, well, you're doing that thing. Let me come up with an interesting way that that is going to interact with the larger scene. And that's what I think as a DM you can do to be better at, to encourage them to come up with things to do. You know, okay, well, they're in this role-playing scene and you're just off in the corner playing cards. How does that you off in the corner playing cards interact with the rest of the scene in that, you know, situation? It may not even be with that directly with that interaction, but maybe you playing cards has raised a big ruckus with things going on and it's distracted the guy. Or, you know, and you know, find some way to have the little things that, that your players mention be important. Tracy?
Oh, I was going to say, if I think Leverage does a great job with this.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not fourth edition, but...
Yeah, awesome.
So part of it is that you are, in a way, kind of splitting up the party. Like, you might only do a scene with two or three of the people, but other people can still do something that adds to it, even though they're not the primary people in the scene, like you were saying with the card game. Or maybe, you know, like during the card game, they overhear a rumor that they really need to go tell the main person. And I think the other thing people can do is, if you want the players to know the information anyway, I guess you could make NPCs that have information they have to get out to the PCs that are currently in the scene. But then it's the other players playing the NPCs instead of the DM.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah. And you've just reminded me that I've got a whole bunch of... I need to start making a list of games that aren't D&D that I want to play at Gen Con.
play Leverage.
Leverage is one of them. Fiasco is one that I've heard a lot of good things I want to play.
Also a great game.
After listening to a DMR recently, I think I'm going to try to email Sam and see if he'll let me squeeze into an Eclipse Phase game. I don't know.
Dragon Age?
I'd like to play Dragon Age as well, yeah.
Get a Dragon Age. Nail down a Enrique.
Yeah.
Yeah,
play cool. Dragon Age.
Anyway.
One of the other great things that Leverage does is they have the flashback scenes. Mm-hmm. So you can have a scene that involves the non-primary players that, like, sets up something that they need in the current scene.
So explain that a little more so people know what it is.
I played a Leverage game where it was important that the main bad guy knows that one of the other guys in my party was an expert at something. So we concocted this whole scene where we made a fake book and put it on his desk. And that way he knew right away that this guy was somebody that was an expert in this field and should be talking to him.
Okay, so if I'm envisioning this as a D&D game, right? The main person in the scene, the main player has gone up and he's starting to talk to this guy in the middle of a tavern or whatever, right? And then the DM turns to you and says, okay, what are you doing to contribute to this scene? And you explain what you've done. Actually, you're not doing it now, but you did it two hours ago or whatever.
Or even like a few minutes ago. So it could have been, let's say you have your squishy wizard is the guy that has to talk to this other guy.
Mm-hmm.
But you're afraid that he's going to pull a dagger on him. You could have your rogue try to, if it looks like a fight's going to happen, say, hey, wait, you know, I want to rewrite this for a second. hey, my rogue went and tried to steal the dagger. And so that's what you try to do. You play through that, see whether or not he could have stolen the dagger before. And there's an assumption that because in leverage you're spending stuff to get this done, there's usually an assumption that's probably going to work.
Okay. Yeah, see, in D&D, I think a lot of people resist that concept. They like to keep things linear in terms of the storytelling because...
It could retcon everything, I know.
Well, and more than that, you sort of, like, I don't know, it stems out of the combat rules, right?
Yeah.
Too often it's, oh, I hit AC 24. Okay, you hit. 5 minutes later, oh, no, wait, I forgot this bonus you didn't hit. Well, you know what? I'm not going back in time and fixing that. and so you sort of get into this mentality when I'm playing D&D, this is the order that things are going in. Time only flows one direction, yeah. And I'm not going back and changing that.
I think you could think of it as, think of this concept as an immediate interrupt in a story scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, and chronologically you are going back, right? You're saying, oh, well, a couple of minutes ago I stole that dagger, even though we didn't talk about it a couple of minutes ago. And I think that's fair. I think... it's okay to be open to that and to try it out and see how it works for your group, and I think that's a really cool idea.
Yeah, it won't work for every group, but you know, but we're not talking about every group. We're talking about your group, and if it happens to work, then hey, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's awesome and cool.
Now, and the trick is, of course, well, if you say that my rogue tried to steal the dagger 5 minutes ago, and then you start rolling dice, and it turns out that you failed horribly, and they caught you trying to steal the dagger. Well, now that completely changes the scene. And do we need to go back and redo it all?
It depends on how you decide to deal with the complication. That.
Right.
Because it could be that you totally got away with it, but it turns out the other guy saw you, and now you're in the back alley, kind of fight that guy.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to handle it, is try it out, you know, not huge things, not huge consequences, not huge rewards, but little things that could actually be important, and then when they go badly, find ways for them to go badly that doesn't change the scene. Oh, right. Your rogue tried to do that 5 minutes ago? Well, they haven't done anything else yet in this scene, so it turns out the reason for that is they got distracted and now they're out in the back alley fighting these guys.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it does work great for, you know, especially when there are people off screen anyways. A lot of times it's purely dead time, like, oh, I was just off twiddling my thumbs anyway. So now you can just assume that they were active and you can, you know, now they've got an actual scene where they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Where the, you know, so that works a lot too.
Cool. Any other bits of advice for dealing with people at the table with different styles or different things they want out of the game?
My big one is not to talk about it. Like, so people need to be able to communicate with each other and everything like that, but in the middle of the game might not be the best time. It might be better to talk after the game and maybe even initially privately with the DM or with the other player if you want to handle it, you know, one-on-one like that.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really difficult dealing, in my experience, with people who... or maybe very rules focused, and in the middle of the game, it's so obvious that they don't like a particular rule or something, and they just keep bringing it up. It's like, okay, I understand.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this later. I can't do anything right now. We're not going to stop the game to have that conversation right now.
Well, I always have that sort of issue. I've got one player who, when I do something different mechanically than what's the rules is written, I have one player that I think. He goes along with it, but I can tell from his body language that he's not happy with it, and it puts me off for like the next hour every time. You know, it's like, oh, he didn't like that, but other people loved what I did. You know, but he's not happy because things didn't go as expected. You know, so
right. Mm-hmm. And talking about the rules differences between editions at the table is just never productive.
Yeah. No edition wars at the table. I think the last one I'd want to throw in is when you have a thing where, you know, I find like a lot of times when there is a kind of, you know, I'm working with these guys and I'm going to go to what these guys are doing, where that boredom gets, where it sort of settles in is when scenes sort of cover too long. So like what I try and do, I call it scene juggling. I'm sure there's a better name for it, but. That's what I'm working with. Basically, I try and get to, in the current scene that I'm going to, I get to a point where there's a good moment of tension or a question that's going to sort of like be lingering into the air. You know, we're going to go through. We've been looking through the room, and now we're going to like open up the cabinet to reveal the secret, stop the scene, go over to the next people, right? And then, you know, like stop it right. Don't like stop it right when something's about to get answered. And so that now you have the people wondering what the people you just left are wondering what the heck is going on, what they're going to see. And now you've shortened the time that that scene goes on. It's much better in my mind to take two scenes and chop them up into 5 minute bits, one after the other, than to do one 20 minute block, then one 20 minute block.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And the last thing I would say is, if you're going to do a longer combat, you know that you have people who aren't big into combat. If you can provide alternative ways for them, kind of like Quinn does with the World Breakers, to contribute to what's to the defeat of the enemy, or however the victory, whatever the victory condition is, you know, maybe it is the rogue gets to climb up and, you know, over time loosen the chandelier that's going to fall down on top of the guy or something like that. It wholly depends on what your players are into, but there can be other ways to provide some of that that will interest people. That's not just, you know, look through my powers, pick which one, and be bored for 5 minutes.
Absolutely. Good. So if I could summarize our two conversations tonight, when building a world breaker, and honestly, when building any monster, I think we've decided that you start with your story. You try to design to make it interesting and memorable. Is that sort of the gist of what we talked about for monster design and world breaker design?
Yes.
And then when it comes to dealing with people of different styles at the table, I think we all just said, grow up and be quiet. Does that summarize that?
And eat your spinach.
And eat your spinach. Yeah, I think those were Quinn's words specifically. No, but we said, you know, first start with the understanding that different people want different things and to let other people have their fun. But then you should try to go out of your way to participate in other people's fun. You know, find the joy in their style, or at least find a way to be engaged in their moment, so that you're doing something as well.
That sounds right.
Does that cover it?
Well, that's episode 179. I want to thank our sponsor, Noble Knight Games, as well as our guest for this episode, Quinn Murphy. Quinn, where can people find you?
You can find me at will4e.net. We've got also a chat room that you can find on there where we're talking about 4E D&D like pretty much 24/7.
Did you get a new domain?
Yep.
At will4e.net.
The old one still works. I haven't cut over yet.
So I can still go to 4E Will?
Before you can go to 4E Will.
I'm sorry, I completely ruined that URL for you.
No. Oh God, I just hear it all the time. There, I just no. It's not you. But you can use either one. But I did add at will4e.net.
At will4e. Is it possible to just get at will? Is that one taken?
No, taken.
Oh darn. All right. Well, and if you want to catch Quinn, of course, you can do that over there, whether it be in his blog or other people's or the chat room or whatever. In fact, I've got one coming up, I think you said next week? That is when my next article's coming out over there?
Yeah, next week, probably around Wednesday, should be.
Right on. And I've got another one already about halfway written as well. So you'll see a few things from me over there in the next few days. And if you want to get a hold of the show in general here, you can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com. Give us a call on the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments on this episode or anything that's coming up that we might be talking about. Anything we're talking about coming up, Tracy? Probably by the time people hear this, we're probably going to be just gearing up for the next book club talk. We've got an interview set up. Should we spoil that for people?
Sure.
Okay. We have an interview set up, towards the end of the month with Ed Greenwood, to talk about his latest novel, which comes out August 2nd. And we've got, preview copies of the book. So we're going to be releasing that episode, the day the book comes out. So if you want to hear if, Barry Elminster Deep, is any good, we'll get to tell you before you have to go out and buy it.
Sweet. Thanks.
And after that, it's going to be all Gen Con stuff. I think August is going to be pretty heavily dominated by Gen Con. I'm going to bring the mic, and I'm going to try to take some time to actually record podcasts there. So, you know, just grab Quinn and bring him up to my hotel room and just record a podcast right there on the spot. I think it'll be great. Yeah. That's right, Quinn. I said I'm gonna kidnap you and take you up to my hotel room. And I thought about it as I said it, and I went ahead with it anyway. So
well, I mean, once you're on a road like that, you just gotta walk it.
and to make the statement even dumber, you're not even gonna be there at Gen Con, and I knew that. But you get the point. And besides that, make sure you consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us going. And if you go to Amazon through the Tomes Amazon store, anything you buy at Amazon gives us some credit. So it doesn't have to be D&D stuff. You know, I've actually gotten credit for somebody who bought a $500 vacuum once. It was awesome. Yes. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com.
So we have threatened to release the chain, the Freed, in order to get the people at the table to be quiet and let me play my game. In any case, this has been the episode 179 of the World Breakers and different playstyles of...
I'm on the wall.